books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and this is a love-themed show for Valentine's Day, featuring Fiona Lucas on Always and Only You, Joanna Toy on The Little Penguin Bookshop, Rachel Greenlaw on the Woodsmoke Women's Book of Spells, and audio describer Liz Gutman on writing spicy audio for Bridgerton. Plus, I find a pile of books on all sorts of love in the RNIB library. All coming up in today's Read On.
1, 2, I make a little dip to get a better swing, and then 3. I squeeze my eyes shut and send it flying up and over my head. I turn round to track its progress and see that there, right beside my maid of honour, is Simon. There's a moment of complete hush where all other eyes in the room are trained on the floral missile. But he locks his on me. I hold my breath as Gil and I watch to see where it lands. There's no larking around now. Women jostle, rise onto their toes, straining just to get a millimetre closer. One of my tall cousins is right behind Anjali, ready to intercept the bouquet with her long arms. But Taryn grabs for it a split second too late, and another hand shoots out and wraps around the ribbon-bound stems. Not Anjali's, but Simon's.
So we're welcoming back today a friend of the show, Fiona Lucas. You've been on twice. Last we chatted about Never Forget You. So this time, tell us about Always and Only You.
Well, this was a book I pitched a ton of different ideas to my editor, and I really only had one sentence to go on when I started, or one and a half sentences, which was, what would you do if you walked down the aisle on your wedding day and the wrong man was waiting for you and nobody else just seemed to think anything was out of place? That's what I started with.
She spins around to see who robbed her of her rightful prize, ready to put up a fight. But when she sees who it is, she falters. He does a gallant little bow and hands it to her. She holds it up triumphantly, beaming at everyone and shooting me a you-almost-blew-it look. Then she turns back to Simon to thank him. But Simon isn't looking at her. He's looking at me. And when he sees Gil slide a possessive arm around my waist, his expression hardens, and he wraps his arms around Anjali and pulls her into an enthusiastic kiss. More cheering, even louder than before. Because it's what everyone roots for at a wedding, isn't it? The best man and the maid of honour finding romance? What could be more perfect? What could be more terrible?
We spoke last time about Never Forget You. Are there echoes of amnesia in this book?
Well, kind of. I suppose it depends. There's an element of kind of a medical condition, but not necessarily. Amnesia can be associated with it, but it's not the main part of it, if you know what I mean. So my main character has a serious head injury. So there's a little bit of trauma, brain trauma and things going on as part of that. One of the most fascinating bits was some of the research I did. So I'm going to have to give a few spoilers away here, is that I needed to find a reason why my main character might end up thinking she was getting married to someone else and maybe almost having a bit of an alternate life for a few chapters. And I came across a TikTok actually that Richard Hammond did, talking about, and the Top Gear presenter, talking about being in hospital after he had a massive crash in a jet-propelled car. I've read his biography about it since, his memoir about it since. And he was talking about, he was unaware, he was unconscious. He was just walking through a favourite place in the Lake District, enjoying the view. And he approached a certain tree and he started to feel like, I'm going to be in trouble if I go any further past this tree. I feel like I really shouldn't go that far, that I need to turn back. And it wasn't long after that he woke up from his coma. And what he didn't know is his wife had been told it was looking pretty dicey and that she should prepare for the worst. And she asked the doctors, can I shout at him? And they said, yeah, well, do, try anything. So she just shouted at him and swore at him and told him, don't you dare leave me. You better flipping well wake up. And he woke up. And he believes that the sense of that he was in trouble was because part of his brain was processing his wife shouting at him. And it reminded me of a story a friend of mine had. She had quite a significant stroke in 2012. While she wasn't actually in a coma, as far as she was concerned, she was having a lovely cruise round. She went to St. Lucia, Nigeria, and then Australia and New Zealand. And it felt utterly real to her, didn't feel like a dream or anything. And when she put her key in her front door when she got home and turned the key, she woke up and found herself in hospital. And that's when she kind of became conscious. And this I then started researching this idea of what happens sometimes to our brain. It takes us to different places, maybe when there's something traumatic going on. And maybe that was a good explanation for what was happening to my character. So researching that was absolutely fascinating. The more I researched, the more fascinating it got. People had like 20-year lives. They thought they'd live somewhere else while they'd been unconscious, or invented whole towns that they lived in and went to coffee and went to work. And but it's rare, but it's happens enough that it's not completely unknown. So.
One question I was going to ask, I was thinking about Gil. At the start of the book, she finds him quite difficult. How do you turn the reader's opinion of a difficult character around?
I did some sneaky things where, although the book is first person, I've got like a timeline going on in the past, which reveals a little bit more about who he is and what he's thinking, even if you're not getting his perspective in the present day. And that was my little secret weapon to kind of make readers fall in love with him even before, hopefully, my character did.
When I talked to you about Never Forget You, you said that your multiple timelines for a bit of a nightmare to write, you're not making life easy for yourself.
No, I seem to every time I say I'm not going to do another book like this, and then comes the idea, and now I'm trying to work out how to tell a book where I'm only doing one day a year, and then I've got to try and work out what happened the first time. Is it going to have the same thing going to happen this time, and how does it all kind of fit together to take me where I started the book at year 10? Yeah, I probably should try and make life easier for myself, but I don't seem to be able to.
I'm picturing a cork board with post-it notes and little threads going across it, things.
I've got one of those, yes.
I'm watching my best friend and the man I love making out right in front of my face. Someone yells, "Get a room!" And everyone laughs. But I don't laugh. I want to be sick. I want to look away. But I can't seem to make my body follow the instructions my brain is giving it. I'm frozen. And when Simon's hand smooths down Anjali's back to cup her bottom, I feel vomit in the back of my mouth. I look away and see Gil staring. He's just as astonished as I am. "You said we were out of here the moment the bouquet toss was done?" I manage to croak out. He nods. "Then let's get out of here."
Next up in today's Love Story Compilation, Joanna Toy. Now, although we're recording this on a very stormy day, but this show, if everything goes well, should be broadcast on Valentine's Day. And romance finds Carrie in the Little Penguin Bookshop in the shape of a dashing young officer.
Yes, there is always romance in this kind of book, historical fiction, saga, call it what you will. And on her birthday, again, because you have to get the ball rolling, Carrie makes one of those things that we now call a random act of kindness. This young chap is browsing the books at the bookstore and explains to her that he's got no change. He'd like to buy a book. He's got no change because he spent the last of his money on a bunch of flowers, which are not for her, which leads to some confusion. And she gifts him a book. She gives him A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway, which was the book he'd been glancing through. And off he goes. He has to join his train, but he he comes back to redeem himself and pay her the sixpence if she wants it. And that leads to their relationship.
Carrie hurried down the platform, past the poster urging people to ask themselves, "Is your journey really necessary?" It made Mr. Bayliss, the station master, so indignant he huffed and puffed like one of the engines. As if he was going to be out of a job, what with the number of troop trains halting at Brockington Junction, the airmen disembarking for Biggin Hill and Kenly, and the soldiers doing the same for Caterham Barracks. Carrie glanced into his office as she passed and saw him brushing his bowler hat, his back to the fire. Fussy, self-important little man. Then she came to the tea room, with its battered metal signs advertising Brook Bond Tea and Fuller's Walnut Cake, the door with the jangling bell above and the doormat set into the mosaic tiled floor. There, at the table nearest the stove, two dark heads were bent over a newspaper, chuckling together. "Aha!" Carrie exclaimed. "Two birds with one stone."
Now we're moving on to book two, which is a new chapter, and there's no spoilers for book one. As we open a new chapter, Mike has been sent to Washington as an envoy, leaving Carrie alone.
Yes, that's right. I mean, what you can be sure of in the war is that whenever you bring a couple together, they're going to be parted. So in book one, Mike had to go off to Dunkirk, and there was a lot of drama associated with his return. In book two, they have no sooner got back together than he is posted off to Washington. Now, this is really very good luck for Carrie and indeed for Mike because he will be safe there. And it's particularly welcome as Johnny, who is Carrie's twin brother, is by now getting involved in, well, he's already been through the Battle of Britain. Of course, the Blitz is about to start. So, ironically, Mike is safer than Carrie, who is under the threat of nightly bombing raids. Johnny is not without his own dramas. And of course, Carrie has by now made good friends with two other women who are on the station, the woman porter, young woman porter, Penny, and Betty, who runs the tea room and who has a waitress in there called Ruby. So all of the women, again, just as in the shop girls, on the home front, it was the women who were the kind of domestic army and kept things going. And Carrie needs her friends and family to support her when Mike is away, particularly because the bookstore comes under threat itself. So she has financial worries that she's got to overcome as well. Now, will Mike get back from Washington? What happens? I'll have to leave that hanging, but I do like a happy ending.
Penny sat back, and Johnny jumped up to greet her. "I heard you'd skived off." "I was not skiving." Carrie gave her brother an affectionate punch on the arm. "What's your excuse?" "You don't mind if I have 24 hours off from helping to defend the skies?" Johnny retorted. "So you can sleep safe in your bed?" Johnny was a pilot, and not just any old pilot. He was one of the few, the Spitfire pilots who'd defeated the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain. He was so good, in fact, that he'd been given a training role, but he was itching to get back in the air, and Carrie knew it wouldn't be long before he wore his superiors down and they had to let him.
Now, book one and book two, if it's not in the RNIB library just now, as you're listening to this, it's on its way very soon. They're both narrated by Katie Sobey. Were you involved in her casting?
Penguin sent me three samples of potential readers, and I like Katie's voice because it's fresh and young, and it's got that sort of hopeful and optimistic quality that I wanted in Carrie and my heroine. I think she sounds as if she's got a bit of spirit, really.
For now, she was enjoying the relief. She and her parents had had enough scares when he was flying, and if he was ground-based, he was at least a tiny bit safer. "Do you want one?" He indicated the half-drunk cups of tea on the table. "No time,"
said Carrie. Talking of which... She extended her wrist from her coat sleeve, and Johnny whistled.
So that was the police cars we heard. Daring daylight raid on a jeweller's.
You are a clod, Penny spoke up. She's had lunch with Mike, hasn't she? I bet that's a present from him.
Spot on, Carrie admitted.
Like it? It's gorgeous, Penny said kindly.
That's a clip of Katie Sobey reading from a new chapter at the Little Penguin Bookshop. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, let's take a trip to the RNIB library. Love isn't all about roses. It can take many forms, from the first flush of romance to the everyday love we feel for our family and friends. Sometimes we mistake obsession for love, or let good love go bad. In honour of this season, here are some of our favourite books about love in all its shapes and sizes, all available to borrow from RNIB libraries. First up, under Love and Romance, I Capture the Castle.
I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith. I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I've padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cosy. I can't say that I'm really comfortable, and there is a depressing smell of carbolic soap, but this is the only part of the kitchen where there is any daylight left.
Read by Candida Gubbins, I Capture the Castle is a coming-of-age story told through the eyes of 17-year-old Cassandra. She and her family are living in increasing poverty as her novelist father struggles with writer's block. But the arrival of a wealthy American family and two unmarried brothers brings hope to Cassandra and her sister.
How odd it is to remember that tea once meant afternoon tea to us. Little cakes and thin bread and butter in the drawing room. Now it is as solid a meal as we can scrape together as it has to last us until breakfast. We have it after Thomas gets back from school. Stephen is lighting the lamp. In a second now, the rosy glow will have gone from the kitchen. But lamplight is beautiful too.
I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith is talking book number 13308. And staying under the heading of Love and Romance, Me Before You. Louisa is hired to care for Will, a quadriplegic who's given up on life. The story should be cliched, but in Me Before You, which is read by Lucy Scott, Jojo Moyes has written a realistic and intelligent novel with a healthy dose of comic relief.
I am not thick. I'd just like to get that out of the way at this point. But it's quite hard not to feel a bit deficient in the department of brain cells, growing up next to a younger sister who has not just moved up a year into my class, but then to the year above. Everything that is sensible or smart, Katrina did first, despite being 18 months younger than me. Every book I ever read, she had read first. Every fact I mentioned at the dinner table, she already knew. She's the only person I know who actually likes exams. Sometimes I think I dress the way I do because the one thing Trina can't do is put clothes together. She's a pullover and jeans kind of a girl. Her idea of smart is ironing the jeans first.
Me Before You is talking book number 19527. Also under Love and Romance, Oscar and Lucinda. Peter Carey's Man Booker Prize-winning novel, read by Nigel Graham, is an unusual love story. Oscar, a Cornish priest, bets Lucinda, an Australian heiress, that he can build her a glass church in the Australian outback, a gamble which will change both their lives.
This was in Devon, near Torquay. To pretend, as Theophilus did, that this was almost tropical is like referring to a certain part of Melbourne as the Paris end of Collins Street. It's quite reasonable if you've never been to Paris, but once you've been there, you can see the description as nothing more than wishful thinking. When I visit Devon, I see nothing tropical. I'm surprised, rather, that so small a county can contain so vast and indifferent a sky. Devon seems cruel and cold. I look at the queer arrangements of rocks up on the moor and think of ignorance and poverty and cold, always the cold.
Oscar and Lucinda by Peter Carey, read there by Nigel Graham, is talking book number 7283.
Also, Love in the Time of Cholera. In Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel Love in the Time of Cholera, which is read by Jonathan Oliver, Florentino and Fermina fall in love in their youth, but Fermina's father persuades her to marry someone else. Undeterred, Florentino waits for his love to return to him as the years and decades pass.
Florentino Ariza, on the other hand, had not stopped thinking of her for a single moment since Fermina Daza had rejected him out of hand after a long and troubled love affair 51 years, 9 months and 4 days ago. He did not have to keep a running tally, drawing a line for each day on the walls of a cell, because not a day had passed that something did not happen to remind him of her. At the time of their separation, he lived with his mother, Transito Ariza, in one half of a rented house on the Street of Windows, where she had kept a notions shop ever since she was a young woman, and where she also unravelled shirts and old rags to sell as bandages for the men wounded in the war. He was her only child, born of an occasional alliance with the well-known shipowner Don Pius V Loaiza, one of the three brothers who had founded the River Company of the Caribbean, and thereby given new impetus to steam navigation along the Magdalena River. Don Pius V Loaiza died when his son was 10 years old. Although he always took care of his expenses in secret, he never recognized him as his son before the law, nor did he leave him with his future secure, so that Florentino Ariza used only his mother's name, even though his true parentage was always common knowledge.
Love in the Time of Cholera is talking book number 13505. The next few books about love are under the heading of family ties, and next up is Gilead. In Gilead by Marlon Robinson, read by Kim Jerome, the elderly and dying Reverend John Ames records his life and the experiences of his father and grandfather before him to share with his 7-year-old son. Never sentimental, the novel is a poignant reflection on life and what we leave behind, and how our families shape us.
I saw a bubble float past my window, fat and wobbly and ripening toward that dragonfly blue they turn just before they burst. I looked down at the yard, and there you were, you and your mother, blowing bubbles at the cat. Such a barrage of them that the poor beast was beside herself at the glut of opportunity. She was actually leaping in the air, our insouciant Soapy. Some of the bubbles drifted up through the branches, even above the trees. You two were too intent on the cat to see the celestial consequences of your worldly endeavors. They were very lovely. Your mother is wearing her blue dress, and you are wearing your red shirt, and you are kneeling on the ground together with Soapy between you, and that effulgence of bubbles rising, and so much laughter. Ah, this life, this world.
Gilead by Marlon Robinson is talking book number 17484. Also under the heading of Family Ties, Behind the Scenes at the Museum.
I am conceived to the chimes of midnight on the clock on the mantelpiece in the room across the hall. The clock once belonged to my great-grandmother, a woman called Alice, and its tired chime counts me into the world.
Read by Susan Jameson, Behind the Scenes at the Museum was Kate Atkinson's first novel, and promised all the great things that we now expect of her today. In this hilarious and sometimes heartbreaking family saga, the central character, Ruby Lennox, chronicles the lives of the 4 generations of women in her family, leading to her own.
Frank spent most of the rest of his leave with one or other of the girls. He took Nellie to the music hall at the Empire, and Lillian took him to a meeting at the educational settlement, but it was a bit above his head. They were all Quakers and conches and socialists, and they kept on about negotiating an end to the war. Frank thought they were a load of slackers and was glad he was in uniform. "Do you think you should be mixing with folk like these?" he said to Lillian as he walked her home, and she just looked at him and said, "Frank," and laughed. More enjoyable was when all 3 of them went to see Jane Shore at the new picture house in Coney Street, which had just opened and was really grand with its 1,000 tip-up seats. When he had to go back to the front, he felt worse than he had done leaving the first time, and he could hardly bear to leave Nell and Lillian behind.
Behind the Scenes at the Museum is not available in giant print, but it's talking book number 13467. Also, under the heading of Family Ties, Wise Children. Angela Carter's book, read by Gretel Davis, is a body romp worth of Shakespeare taking us on a wild ride through the tangled fortunes of two families, the Hazards and the Chances. From the point of view of 75-year-old dancing twins, Dora and Nora Chance.
Welcome to the land of make-believe, to where the moon shone on Charlie Chaplin every moonlight night. Welcome to dreamland. We'd only ever seen a palm tree before at Bournemouth. It came as a shock. So big, so hairy. And the sunshine, like a benediction, said Irish. He was so pleased I'd got it up for him that even the weather seemed intentional. But I wouldn't move in with him, not on your life. I got too much residual sense for that, although I must say I was very struck. Struck with his faded but still potent charm, his vulnerability under his surface assurance, his soft, light baritone with its gracious East Coast modulations, his wasted talent, of which even the morbid scripts he now churned out at so many dollars the yard retained some wizened gleam. But he did wonders for my grammar, not to mention my grasp of metaphor, as witness the style of this memoir.
That's Angela Carter's Wise Children. Finally, at our look at some alternative books about love, let's look at Passion, Betrayal and Obsession, starting with The Good Soldier. A tale of dissolving marriages, death and madness. The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, read by Peter Wickham and Thomas C. Moser, is narrated by the character John Dowell, who relates the story of two marriages, his own and that of his two close friends. But all is not as it seems, and very soon a tangled web of illicit affairs and betrayal is revealed.
Lady Elizabeth had been instructed by Sir Harry to warn her daughter not to fall in love with Cousin George during his visit to Humblethwaite. And Lady Elizabeth was, as a wife, accustomed to obey her husband in all things. But obedience in this matter was very difficult. Such a caution as that received is not easily given even between a mother and a child, and is especially difficult when the mother is unconsciously aware of her child's superiority to herself. Emily was in all respects the bigger woman of the two, and was sure to get the best of it in any such cautioning. It is so hard to have to bid a girl, and a good girl too, not to fall in love with a particular man.
The Good Soldier is available from RNIB, and staying under the heading of Passion, Betrayal and Obsession, Atonement. Ian McEwan's book, read by Carol Boyd, is a family saga which begins in 1935 and continues through the Second World War and on to the present day. It follows the devastating consequences of a young girl's mistake, in particular for the young lovers whose lives are ripped apart in the wake of their actions.
Bryony sat on the floor with her back to one of the tall built-in toy cupboards and fanned her face with the pages of her play. The silence in the house was complete. No voices or footfalls downstairs, no murmurs from the plumbing. In the space between one of the open sash windows, a trapped fly had abandoned its struggle, and outside, the liquid birdsong had evaporated in the heat. She pushed her knees out straight before her, and let the folds of her white muslin dress and the familiar, endearing pucker of skin about her knees fill her view. She should have changed her dress this morning. She thought how she should take more care of her appearance, like Lola. It was childish not to, but what an effort it was.
Atonement by Ian McEwan is talking book number 13411. And finally, The Collector. In The Collector by John Foles, read by William Abney, a lonely young butterfly collector kidnaps an art student and keeps her captive in his cellar. Told from both points of view, this dark, tense novel charts the emotions of each character as the confinement continues.
Just before I shut the door, she said, You've forgotten your lighter. I've got another. I hadn't. Thank you, she said. It was funny, she almost smiled. I made the Nescafe and I took it into her and she watched me drink some and then she drank some. All the time she asked questions. No, all the time I felt she might ask a question, she'd come out quickly with a question to try and catch me. About how long she had to stay, why I was being so kind to her. I made up answers, but I knew they sounded feeble. It wasn't easy to invent quickly with her.
The Collector, the last in this list of alternative books about love, is talking book number 4532. For more information on how to get any of the books mentioned in that list, head to www.rnib.org.uk or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The Second World War caused a metal shortage, which had an unexpected effect for Talking Books listeners.
The American Foundation for the Blind sent us a gift of 500,000 gramophone needles, and of course needles became blunt. If you don't have needles to play these gramophone records, you just couldn't hear them, basically. So the blunter the needles became, the worse the sound became, so we needed new needles to keep the thing going.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Next up, let's hear from Rachel Greenlaw. The audio version of the Woodsmoke Woman's Book of Spells is read by Kirsten Atherton.
I needed this moment. It's grown inside me like a nettle, this need, curling around me all these years, stinging me as I turned the other way. But now that the moment is here, I find it is full of ghosts. I turn the key in the lock and fumble with the handle, my fingers slipping over the worn iron and push. The hinges protest, but the door gives with a low sigh. Inside, it's dark and cold, so much colder than the outside world. I feel the cool air twine around me like an arm, guiding me in, pulling me past the doorway. Perhaps it is Ivy, my grandmother, welcoming me back. I let my eyes adjust, finding the wide flagstones, the crooked staircase, and I step over the threshold.
It follows the story of Carrie Morgan, who returns to her small hometown of Woodsmoke after 10 years away to renovate her late grandmother's cottage. And while she's there, she meets a man as the frost settles in late autumn, who her witchy family warn her might not be real, who might disappear as the frost thaws in spring, leaving her broken heart behind. And it's told from three perspectives, Carrie, Cora and Jess. And it's a story about belonging and what home truly means. It's also a love letter to nature and an exploration of stories passed down through generations and the ups and downs of motherhood.
My boots clatter on the floor, echoing down the hallway as I move past the staircase. I run a hand over the wood, feel the smooth varnish, then the rough patches where time has worn it away. It's familiar in the way a dream is upon waking. I haven't been in this house in 10 years, and somehow it seems smaller, frailer than it did 10 years ago. Without the true owner of the place, singing in her sweet, reedy voice as she potters around, the cottage holds an air of neglect, of being left too long in the dark, all forgotten. I shake off the cold, drawing my coat a little tighter across my chest, and take the doorway on the left into the front room. The fireplace is littered with the remains of a bird's nest, and a chair lies on its side, as though hastily tipped over. I reach out and right it, but a leg comes off in my hands. "Oh, Ivy," I sigh, dropping it back on the floorboards. I don't bother trying the light switch. The electrics won't work. Cora, my great aunt, said as much in her letter. In a rush, I move to the next room, to the kitchen spread across the back, circling the old farmhouse table and peering out of the back windows. And there they are, the giants that loom over me in every dream, every nightmare. The reason, perhaps, that I have been running for so long.
Where do you think Woodsmoke is?
Oh gosh, now this is an interesting question because I first got the idea after a writing retreat in the snowy mountains of Colorado. And I loved the kind of ominous presence of the mountains and the woods and the snow, how like beautiful it was, but how like stark and, you know, you just don't know what's there. It's just so vast. But also Woodsmoke is inspired, the actual small town of Woodsmoke is inspired by the town I grew up in rural North Cornwall. And it's also inspired by the kind of the landscape where I live on the Isles of Scilly, with all the kind of like nature trails that crisscross between fields and things, which is where Cora takes her dog Kep for a walk really often in the book. So I kind of put these all together and I made up an entirely fictional town, which I believe is somewhere in the UK.
Now tell us about the Morgan Compendium.
So the Morgan Compendium is the book of stories and recipes and spells that's passed down through generations of Morgan women who have all lived in Woodsmoke. And it's passed from grandmother to granddaughter. So it skips a generation. And it's a way of documenting things that happen in Woodsmoke, the women's stories of Woodsmoke, things that happen on the mountains. And there are small excerpts at the beginning of some of the chapters of some of the stories in the Morgan Compendium.
And there's a very thin line in the book, I think, between the real world and the magical. Was that a difficult tightrope to walk?
Well, it's really a reflection of how I feel about the natural places in our world and like the wild places. Because it's very often I will go on a walk in the winter on the Isles of Scilly when there's nobody else around, when it's a bit stormy or it's a bit foggy, and it just feels like I could turn my head and see something that any human would believe shouldn't exist. So it's that feeling that there is something around us, that surrounds us, that's just beyond our understanding, that we can't really explain with science or with modern thinking. And I wanted to capture that feeling, that essence, in this book.
Now, you said when you were last on with One Christmas Morning that that book was indirectly inspired by being in a lockdown. Was there a little more feeling of freedom in this book?
I think so. It's also a reflection of just how I feel about motherhood and also like what home and belonging means. And I especially think about this when I think of the island where I live, which is incredibly remote in the middle of the Atlantic. And I do feel a strong connection to here. But I also feel a strong connection to the mainland UK, where I lived 21 years of my life. And it's just that question of like, what is home and what is the place where we're meant to be, and is it a person or that we want to be tied to or that we feel we belong with, or is it the place itself that roots us? So I kind of explored that through each of the perspectives as well in the story.
Yeah, you don't make life easy for yourself. Your first book was multiple characters. This one's got three points of views in different timelines.
When I first wrote the manuscript, it was in a very different shape to how it is now. And with every single book that I have published, that I write, I always want to be testing myself and just kind of expanding my kind of abilities craft-wise. And so with this book, I wanted to see if it was possible to write a multi-POV story with a kind of a non-linear plot as well. And I worked with my editors to get it in a more coherent form so that a reader could read it and not be completely confused.
And you wrote the first draft of One Christmas Morning very quickly. Was it the same with this one?
No, it was not, definitely. So the Woodsmith Woman's Book of Spells, I wrote it in pieces, and I did think about it for a long time, and I kind of wrote it in between other projects like Compass and Blade, my YA fantasy, and it took quite a long time to kind of tease the secrets out of each of the characters and to really get under the skin of each of them. So it took a great deal longer. It probably took me about a year in between writing other projects, like dipping in and out, before I had a full first draft of it.
When I wake, winter has come. I fight my way out of the blankets, drawing in lungfuls of soothing air. It's stifling in the caravan. The walls too close, the ceiling too low. I drag a hand over my face, banishing the cobwebs of dreams, and shuffle around the small space, making coffee with the old whistling kettle, shrugging into my coat, pulling on my boots. I clutch the rough ceramic sides of my favourite coffee mug in my hands, the one I found in a small pottery in Ireland many years ago. I let the steam curl around my face. Then I step out into the frost.
Now, there are three points of views in the book. Was there ever a discussion to have three different audiobook narrators?
Oh, gosh. No, there wasn't. I actually, we were really lucky with the narrator that we've got. She's just phenomenal, and she's narrated so many fantastic audiobooks. So I'm really proud that she wanted to work on Woodsmoke. And I got an email from my UK editor, and she just said, you know, this is who's going to be the narrator, like, fantastic news. And I was like, yeah, it's brilliant. And like, I've listened to clips of it, and her voice is just so smooth and soothing, but it's got that like edge to it, and it just suits the book so perfectly, tonally. So I'm just so pleased that we've got this one narrator who has this range to produce all of the voices.
Let's have a listen.
The field is a painting. All I see are droplets of glitter. The ground, the middle distance, the sky overhead, sparkling with dew. Frost is a scent you cannot bottle. It's sweet and sharp all at once, laced with memories from childhood, from early morning breakfasts, from the moments my heart thumped with the knowing that it was here at last. I hold out my hand, my fingertips already nipped by cold. The chill draping the air is early for this time of year, not yet November. I smile for the first time since I arrived and breathe it in, that scent of frost and cold. And I'm sure, in that moment, that despite my long absence, despite the way I left this place and how it's haunted me ever since, this is my homecoming. This spell of early winter feels alive and wild with magic. The mountains have welcomed me home, after all.
Kirsten Atherton, reading from the Woodsfolk Woman's Book of Spells. Now, I'd hate putting things in boxes, but how would you describe the book? Would you say it was a love story or a mystery or a drama or somewhere in between?
I'm going to dodge this question a little bit. And I'm going to say, I feel it's genre blend. And I'm a big fan of genre blending stories, because I feel like, as writers, we shouldn't box in our writing. But I know that that gives librarians and booksellers a real headache. But I feel it's women's fiction, because it's a real exploration of women's voices and thoughts and feelings. But it's also a love story, and it's also a mystery. It's also speculative fiction. And so I've kind of taken bits out of several different genres and pieced them together to create what I wanted to create.
Finally, on today's Read On Love compilation, let's hear how to audio describe some of the spicier scenes of Bridgerton. So, with Bridgerton, are you writing in the style of the era or the style of the book? So, you having to use older vocabulary, because you can't obviously say she's holding a book the size of an iPhone or something.
Right.
You can't take people out of the scene. So, are you writing in that age?
Yeah, that was one of the big swings that we took with Bridgerton, because that's not necessarily a sort of, I'm doing air quotes, accepted or standard way of doing audio description. But reading has always been my favorite pastime. And I don't know, maybe I was a weird kid. I loved a lot of H.G. Wells and Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, specifically Sherlock Holmes when I was a kid, and just always loved, you know, it's so interesting to read English that you understand, but that is in a lot of ways very different than the English that we use today, and particularly the differences between American English and British English. So with Bridgerton, it's really fun to be able to say someone quits the room or takes their leave or hastens away instead of just leaves. It's fun to kind of switch over to that mode. The stylistic aspect to it is really fun for me. And I love language and I love words. And being able to play with language and words in that way has been, it's a real privilege. And we're really, really lucky to work with a client like Netflix who knows how much we care about the tracks that we produce and that we take it really seriously. We take the quality really seriously, and they trust us to kind of take those bigger stylistic swings. We're really fortunate to be able to work with a client like that.
It is everything I have wanted to say to you for weeks.
Call me a friend.
Yes, maybe.
He searches her face with wild, shining eyes.
Forgive me. I do not know what I was thinking.
I'd very much like to be more than friends. So much more.
He leans in close, bringing his face to hers. They share a scorching kiss. He wraps his arm around her waist. They separate for a brief moment, then share several deep, slow kisses. She runs her hands up to his face and down his chest. They pause, regarding each other in wonder.
And style aside, there are scenes that are a bit steamy. Do you sometimes feel you're an adult novelist?
A bit, yeah. I mean, it's actually, I'm working on something right now that I feel like it can draw a direct line from my work on Bridgerton to this project. It's another sort of steamy thing. Yeah, I do feel a bit like a romance novelist at times. And it's funny because romance wasn't really a genre I was into pre-Bridgerton. You know, I read Bridgerton before I started writing Bridgerton, because I was like, I gotta know what this is about. I knew the books were incredibly popular. And it's been really fun to expand my vocabulary in that way. It is, again, I love words. It is amazing how words can evoke these really emotional and like physical responses. So, you know, I do my best to keep that sort of, it's not really a cadence, I guess. I do my best to keep that feeling in mind when, you know, when a steamy scene starts happening and I kind of switch over to say, oh, okay, I need to be thinking about, you know, what words are sexy? How can I convey this? So I actually want to give a shout out to a woman named Bojana Kokliat from Alt Text as Poetry, which I suggest everyone check out, because I had a very great conversation with her a couple of years ago after Bridgerton season one about sexy audio description. And, you know, the way a lot of writers were trained and sort of the older school way of thinking is to be objective and to be neutral. And first of all, you can't really ever be objective when you're a describer. It's just not possible. We all bring our own biases and our own lenses and our own experiences to what we're writing. And that's good. You know, you just want to make sure that you're aware of that so you can sort of mitigate them as you're writing. But the objective neutral thing doesn't really work in a lot of cases, and especially in a scene that's really steamy, because you can't be neutral in that situation. Neutral language tends to feel clinical and kind of cold, and it takes you out of the scene. And especially when you have this beautiful music, and you know, Bridgerton is very famous for having these classical arrangements of pop songs that people, you know, spend a lot of time figuring out and anticipating. You have to take all of that into account. So I really credit Bojana with helping me level up my writing of those particular scenes, because some people get embarrassed about it, but you can't. You just have to lean into it, because if you're, as a describer, if you're trying to translate this feeling from the visuals into something that someone is listening to, you have to be feeling that too. And you have to be channeling that into the words that you're using. So yeah, it all flows from emotion and being able to kind of convey that in a way that makes all viewers feel just as flustered as other viewers.
When I used to work in R&IB talking books, you could always tell in the green room which actor had just done a sex scene.
Oh, yeah.
A bit red in the face and fanning themselves. But, all right,
yeah, that's what I'm going for. That's the goal. Red in the face and fanning yourself.
Her lips find his. They share several long, smoldering kisses.
Oh, Colin.
What?
We're at your house.
Oh, God. Could the carriage driver not keep on driving?
She covers her grin with her hand.
You think anyone saw us? I was not paying much attention to anything.
His smile fades. They gaze deeply into one another's eyes. They share a tender, lingering kiss. Their noses brush as they open their eyes. He gently slips her sleeve back onto her shoulder and straightens a lock of her hair.
What are you doing?
He studies her face with an earnest, open-mouthed expression. He drops his gaze and swallows, then looks back up at her. He lifts his chin.
Colin.
He stands outside the open carriage door. He offers his hand.
You're coming with me?
Now, audio descriptions, one of the things that the producers and the directors don't really think about until, as you say, post-production, after the fact, is it a balancing act? Sometimes you've got a really busy scene where you've got to describe something, say one of the more elaborate outfits in season three. Is it hard sometimes to find a spot to adequately describe what's on screen?
Yes, always, particularly with something like Bridgerton, because yeah, the fashions are such a huge thing. You know, I do my best to, if there's one particular thing that I'm like, okay, people are definitely going to be talking about this. Like there are a couple of the queen's wigs that really, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to sacrifice something else for this because people are going to be talking about this wig. I need to make sure I get some kind of description of this wig in here. You have to keep stuff like that in mind. Like what are, because that's a big part of audio description too, right? Is making sure that everyone is kind of on equal footing when it comes to gathering around the proverbial water cooler the next day. And, you know, what have you been watching? Oh, you know, you saw Bridgerton. Oh my God, the Queen's wigs. I know, right? You kind of have to keep that in mind too. That's also important information. So even if it's not crucial to understanding a scene, it's still really, it's really such a huge part of the texture and the richness of that show. And I hate having to choose because one thing about this last season is Cressida Cowper has such fantastic hair and dresses always. They're always so outré and like very, it's not really vulgar, that's a little too harsh maybe, but just very extra, I guess. There's never time to properly describe her, you know, how her hair is braided into a cage or something like that. I really wish that we had more opportunities for an introduction or a pre-show, which is standard in live audio description, where, you know, you get to your seat half an hour ahead of time or whatever, and there's description happening already about the space and the sets and the main characters and their costumes and how the sets move and the lighting and things like that. I think that There is not a single project I've worked on in the 6 years I've been writing audio description that would not benefit from at least a brief audio introduction track. There's just always stuff that we don't have time to describe. So yeah, it's a really fine line trying to, you know, make sure that any important music is coming through, sound effects are coming through, but also to get in as much detail as we can. And it's even trickier when there's a lot of dialogue happening. Comedies are particularly tough for that as well. Especially now, the style a lot of the time is wall-to-wall talking and a lot of quick edits and things like that. And it complicates things too when there are, you know, little chat windows open up to show what people are texting to each other while they're talking, and you have to figure out how to get that in. It's always a kind of a tightrope act.
I can imagine some scenes been much harder than others. Like, say the scene is the Duke enters the ballroom, but what you're missing with the audio description, what you need to put in, is all the glances he's getting, all the facial expressions and things like, you know, the nuanced things that could easily be missed.
Yeah, and in those cases you just kind of have to do your best to, you know, maybe summarize, you know, enters to an adoring crowd or something like that, or or, you know, if there are little smaller bits to get in, mention a couple individual reactions if you can. It's always there. This is why at the end of the day, when I'm done with work, I cannot make any more decisions. I can't make decisions about dinner. I can't make decisions about what to watch or what to do or what to read or where to go. Or I've made all the decisions I can at work, and I'm just decisioned out, because that's all it is. It's making a ton of decisions in every moment for every scene about what you're going to describe and what you have to leave behind.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.